Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday. You're listening to Bhavani on IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm very excited to be with you today. I have an exciting show. Not only do I have a great recipe to share with you, but I have a wonderful guest who is a colleague and friend, Nancy Romer. And she's the founder of the Brooklyn Food Coalition and also a professor of psychology at Brooklyn College. And I'm really excited to have her on because she's been on sabbatical this year, traveling around and really seeing some wonderful examples of sustainable food examples around the world. And I'm going to be having her on talking to us about some of that and some of her upcoming travels. And there's also things going on around the city that I want to share with you. Tonight is a slow food meeting here on Long Island. Slow Food Huntington meets the second Tuesday of every month at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. And the meeting is from 7 to 9 tonight. So if you can make it, we'd love to see you there. December 24th is our annual Christmas feast for the homeless or the needy at Rufus King Park. That's the same place that we did our Thanksgiving feast. This is in Jamaica, Queens, and it's the day, because this year the Tuesday before Christmas happens to fall on Christmas Eve Day, we're expecting record numbers of people. This year for Thanksgiving we had a line like was unbelievable. Usually we feed everybody in a couple hours, and we were there for 5 hours on Thanksgiving. So I'm expecting a big crowd, so we're collecting toys and coats, all kinds of sizes of coats, blankets, as well as donations towards the food. So if you want to help, you can go to my website, iegreen.com, and there's a sign up there, a doodle document where you can sign up for different shifts to help. On January 8th, I am pushing to try to fill a couple of buses from Long Island to go up to the rally in Albany, at the state capitol for fracking or anti-fracking rally. And the rally starts at 11 o'clock. We have buses leaving from Long Island as well as Manhattan and all parts of New York State. And we need to let Governor Cuomo know that we do not want fracking in New York. The examples of what fracking has done to communities around the country are quite visible. And we don't want that here in New York. And, of course, we'd love fracking not to be anywhere in the country. So we all need to do what we can to push for more renewable energy sources. But in the meantime, the rally here in New York is January 8th, and Food and Water Watch is coordinating the buses. So you can go to their website, Food and Water Watch, to sign up for a bus. The buses are, there's a minimal charge for the bus, but there is also scholarships available. So if money is the reason you would not go, don't let that stand in your way. There is funding to help you get there. Also, January 24th through the 26th is the annual NOFA Winter Conference, which happens every year up in Saratoga Springs. And this is the 32nd year of this annual organic farming conference. And it's a great, wonderful happening. Unlike the summer conference, this one, all the farmers can come out because they're on break. And it's a great happening. It's a wonderful time to learn about different organic farming methods, as well as networking with other community members, finding interns, if you need interns for the summer, for your organic garden or farm. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful time. There's films and dancing and socializing. So come on up for that, January 24th through the 26th. I believe there's also scholarships for that if money is an issue. January 25th and 26th, there's a honeybee keeping class, and this is the time to start thinking about keeping honeybees. If you want to do it in the spring, you need to start planning for that now and signing up to get some hives. So this two-day class is taking place at the Commons in Brooklyn, January 25th and 26th. You'll be able to find more information about that on my website at iegreen.com. So those are the things going on right now. The recipe I want to share with you is the Tuscan fall stew. But before I do that, I want to let you know a few other things that you'll be able to find out information about on my website. Every week I put on some petitions that I really encourage people to sign up for or sign on to. Right now there is a petition on my website to extend the comment period on GMO apples. Right now they've extended the comment period for GMO apples, but we want to prevent GMO apples from really hitting the market. And what these apples are supposed to do is it prevents them from turning brown. And turning brown is actually a way that we know an apple is fresh. So if an apple doesn't turn brown when you cut it, it's not very fresh. So, you know, as a listener to this show, you are probably on board with wanting to limit GMOs to start with. So this is just one more GMO product that they want to take to market. So please sign the petition for that. Also, there's a big conglomeration of big food monopolies buying up smaller companies. Dean Foods, who owns White Wave, just bought up Earthbound Organics, which is the most prevalent or most popular or largest organic food produce company around, and that is those are the packets that you can find at anywhere from Costco to supermarkets. But Earthbound Organic lettuce, as it is, because they're so big, it's not like buying local at your farmer's market, but at least it's truly organic. And now that White Wave is buying it, we do not know what the future of Earthbound will be. In researching this, I found out that White Wave is also the company that bought Silk brand tofu and Silk milk, and that all was organic when they bought it, and they made a commitment to the owners of Silk that they would keep it organic. And of course, slowly as they took over, the word organic was replaced by natural. And now Silk products, which most people buy thinking it's organic, because once you start buying a product, you don't keep regularly checking the label. Once you see that it's, you know, an organic product, you just keep buying it, and you don't even realize that they've changed that on you. And they remove the organic, and now it just says natural. And soybeans are one of the most GMO crops that we produce here in this country, along with corn and cotton and canola. So that product is certainly GMO now, and you don't want to be buying it. So anyway, so now White Wave is buying up Earthbound, so we do not know what's going to happen to Earthbound. And we would like you to sign a petition to try to keep these corporations under control from buying up all these companies. So sign on to that petition. Also, there's a petition to President Obama and Secretary Kerry to please not approve the Keystone Pipeline. And as you know, I've been a protester of the Keystone Pipeline for years now. I was down in Washington and volunteered to be arrested while protesting, along with Nancy Romer, who is my guest today, I believe was also arrested, protesting this Keystone Pipeline, which is supposed to take the crude oil, dirty, dirty, thick crude oil from Canada down through our country to the Gulf of Mexico, and then export it to other countries. And pipelines always break and burst, and the pollution that it will release onto the land and into the water is just horrendous, and we cannot allow that to happen. So please sign on to that petition. Also, there's a new labeling law for meat, where they will have to show where the meat has come from, the country of origin. And, you know, the meat companies are certainly not happy about that, but it does not include meat such as bacon, organ meats, and turkey. They're exempt from this. So anyway, you want to find out where your meat is coming from when you buy it. As always, you want to try to get local meat. You want to try to get meat from sustainable producers that you know where it's coming from and how it was raised. That is, you know, one of the worst producers of greenhouse gas emissions in our country, and we really want to try to get that down. If everybody starts either buying local meat and eating less of it, that would be a really good thing. So now for my recipe this week, it is a Tuscan fall stew, and it can also be a Tuscan winter stew by just substituting some of the vegetables. When you're cooking, you know, whenever possible, you want to try to use what's in season. So your root vegetables last throughout the winter, if stored properly. And so that's this stew right here. So we're going to use one onion, a tablespoon of minced garlic, four carrots, two celery, one orange pepper. And peppers you want to try to buy organic. And peppers are on the Dirty Dozen list, so it's really important to try to buy your peppers organic. Six baby eggplants, 2 cups of sliced mushrooms, 2 medium potatoes, 1/2 cup white wine, 2+ cups of chopped tomatoes, and this time of year I use canned tomatoes, 1/4 teaspoon of marjoram, 1/4 teaspoon of thyme, 1/4 cup of fresh chopped basil, 1 bay leaf, 1 teaspoon salt, 1/2 teaspoon pepper, and olive oil. Also, I put in fresh chopped parsley here, but I see it's not on the list, but I always add parsley to my stews because I love the flavor, I love the color, and it's so good for you. So anyway, cover the bottom of a heavy stock pot with olive oil. Sauté the onion until translucent. Then add the carrots, the garlic, the baby eggplant, and continue cooking until the eggplant gets soft. You may need to add a little more olive oil because the eggplant absorbs so much oil. But if you prefer, you can always pre-roast the eggplant, which I do sometimes in the oven, to reduce the amount of oil that is absorbed by the eggplant. Then you can add the celery, the peppers, the mushrooms, and potatoes and cook for another 5 minutes. Add all the remaining herbs and let that simmer for about 30 minutes, stirring occasionally, making sure it's not sticking at the bottom. Also feel free to add any acorn squash or butternut squash that you may have still stored around this time of year. And that is it. But like I said, when you are the chef, you are the boss, and you get to substitute whatever vegetables you have. And just get creative. You know, feel free to put in the vegetables that you like or the vegetables that you have. I put in some Brussels sprouts when I've made this in the past. I just play around with it. So have fun and enjoy it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Nancy Romer. As I said before, she's the founder of the Brooklyn Food Coalition, and she's now the chair of the board. And the Brooklyn Food Coalition is a grassroots organization that's dedicated to the vision of a just and sustainable food system in Brooklyn. And not just Brooklyn, though. I know Nancy's commitment is to a sustainable food system around the world. And that's why right now, as I said, she's on sabbatical and she's been traveling around looking at some of these models. And that's why I invited her on again. She was a guest a few years ago. But I wanted to invite her on to talk about the work that she's doing now in looking at these sustainable food models and seeing how they can affect what we're doing here. So Nancy, are you with me?
I am. I'm very interested in making that stew.
Oh, it's great. It's great. This time of year, those are the kind of foods that you go for, you know.
Yeah.
Where in the summer, warm it's so much lighter. But, yeah, in the winter, you definitely want warming foods, and that stew really hits the spot.
Well, we call that kind of stew refrigerator stew because we open our refrigerator, we see what's left, and we add all sorts of goodies to the stew.
Right, you can't go wrong. And that's why I said play with it, you know, and just feel free to add other things and add other spices. And you can also change the mood. I mean, you can make that whole stew and use Indian herbs and make it an Indian dish just by adding curry and cumin and turmeric instead of the marjoram, the basil, and what else? And the thyme. And it's just like a quick little switch, and you have a whole different cultural experience.
So, I'm up for it.
It's really fun. So anyway, I loved, you know, when we were talking before, just hearing about some of your travels. Before we even go there, I want to just ask you, in case people are listening who don't really know what food sovereignty is, what is food sovereignty and what is the global movement to achieve it?
Food sovereignty, you know, we call that really food justice in the United States. But food sovereignty is really a bigger, a more global framework than justice. It's really about reclaiming the food system by the people. It's reclaiming the food system from the corporations, the multinational corporations, and bringing it back home. And it's so interesting to see the various strategies that people use to try to take control back, to use traditional practices, to use collaboration with other farmers, and to see people be so excited about their power as farmers. And, you know, as a kid growing up in New York City, my parents always defamed farmers. You know, they were not smart, according to my parents, who tried to buy things in cellophane, but they were very well socialized to do that. And what I have learned is the genius of farmers. They are scientists. They are intrepid. They work incredibly hard. And what they seem to want to do is to be in control of their own practices and to serve the people in their communities the foods that they want, not the foods that someone's making big profits off of. Mm-hmm. That's basically it. It's reclaiming the food system for your own community. And it's a very anti-corporate perspective. And globally, there's you know, this is something that always shocks me, that the largest non-religious organization in the world is La Via Campesina. It's Peasants' Way. It has over 200 million members from about...
What's the name of it?
La Via Campesina. The La Via is the way of the peasant, Peasants' Way. And it's got 200 million members from 150 different countries, some of them from the United States, but mostly from the Global South, and some from Europe, from Spain, from Italy. But it's a very large, democratically organized organization. They promote a lot of women's leadership, because in fact, what's happening is a transition to women farmers. Because most of the people that are involved in the food sovereignty movement are small and medium holders. They're not the massive farms. They're relatively smaller farms, and also fisher folk. They include fishers and pastoralists and allies like us.
Mm-hmm.
It's so fascinating to see how people in different places reclaim their traditional methods and really increase their productivity as farmers. And they're trying to get off GMOs. They're trying to get off synthetic fertilizers and pesticides, and they're trying to use agroecological practices. And, you know, when we think in this country, organic, that's for the elite. But no, this is really for everyone, and it's wonderful to see people who really live very, very modestly be so proud of their organic farming, and they know that their children are going to be eating healthy food.
Well, it used to be all of our food was organic before,
exactly.
Before all these chemicals came into the Green Revolution, right?
Exactly.
It's so funny. The name Green Revolution makes you think like that might be the organic, sustainable movement. But the Green Revolution was the introduction of all those pesticides. And when was that, the 1940s, 1950s, when that really started taking over? And then GMOs didn't really infiltrate until the, you know, big time, until the 1996, I believe, around then.
Well, you know, after World War II, they had a lot of DDT.
Right.
Left over, all these, the chemical warfare that our government participated in, they had a lot of leftover, so they figured, well, what can we use it for?
Right.
And one of the things they used it for was pest control in agriculture. So they did a couple of things. They moved toward post-to-post farming, that is, you know, monoculture farming. This is under Earl Butz, who was the Secretary of Agriculture under Eisenhower. And they also pushed the use of first DDT, and then once there was a movement to end that because it was so dangerous, they moved toward other pesticides and fertilizers as part of, as you say, you know, part of the Green Revolution. They realized they could convince farmers that they would have a greater yield, and they do.
At first,
but then after about 7 years, it becomes all these problems start arising. The pests adapt and they grow stronger, and the weeds grow stronger, and the productivity goes down. But they've been hooked on these inputs in these GMOs, and they also owe a lot of money. So it becomes a situation where it's very hard to get out of. You have to have a lot of support to get out of that system. You know, it's almost like parents trying to feed their kids healthy food. If you start doing it from birth, it's much easier. If you start doing it when they're 10, you really need a system to support you,
right,
and a peer group to support you, to help you and your kids move away from something that's harmful.
Right.
So,
well, I remember that's so true. I remember, you know, when you can have peer pressure work in the positive, it's such a rare thing, but it's so wonderful. Because I took over the cafeteria at the Waldorf School after the Waldorf School was having, even though their philosophy in education is a more natural philosophy, the cafeteria did not resemble that. And so parents got together and really pushed to take over the cafeteria and have it be mostly organic and, you know, GMO-free, antibiotic-free, all that kind of stuff. And at first there was a lot of pushback from some of the people that didn't want that, but the kids that were enjoying it really sold the other kids. I mean, the salad bar became the most popular thing. You know, at first people were like, oh, no kids are going to eat salad bar, but oh my God, the salad bar was the hit, you know, and kids were, you know, gobbling up the food, and when you'd see other kids try it, it made kids that were more reluctant to try it want to try it. You know, I would put out little nori rolls for, you know, side dishes and stuff, and people would be buying it, you know, instead of, you know, extra prepackaged snacks, you know, these kids for snacks would get a nori roll, and it was great.
I think when kids have choices, and the choices are good, are all good choices, they start enjoying the ones that they prefer, and
right,
they can be healthier choices. I think that's the brilliance of a salad bar. It's all about choice.
Mm-hmm.
So
right,
people like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I just one thing I want to say about, you know, the food sovereignty movement and why it is so widespread in the global south. A couple of things that I just wanted to mention. You know, one is the percentage of people who are farmers in the global south versus the global north, and then the other is land grabs. So in the United States, you know, our farm population is between 1-2% of our overall population. Very
mm-hmm.
small. For what was an agrarian culture, we are no longer that at all. We have very few farmers, which is a very major problem, because it puts us in complete dependence upon corporate agriculture.
Right.
And I think New York City has something like 3 days worth of food supply. That's a very, very risky position to be in.
Sure.
So in much of the global south, it's more like 75% of the population are farmers. And, of course, it varies tremendously.
Now, global south, does that include
Africa,
you know,
Latin America.
Okay, so it's not just Latin America and Central America. You're also talking about India and...
Yes,
okay,
absolutely. India, Pakistan, you know, all of South Asia, much of Asia. The agrarian societies, basically. They're mostly agrarian societies. When you have a large percentage of your people who are farmers, you can still maintain local distribution. You can still maintain the growing of food and the processing of food that meets the desires and needs of the local population.
Mm-hmm.
When you get rid of those farmers and you push them off the land and you have these monocrops and agribusiness taking over, then the people are forced to eat what's given to them. And so that's part of the struggle that's going on. And land grabs are sort of a key part of this fight, that there are that the land is being grabbed by corporations, sometimes by governments, and then given to or sold to the highest bidder, which are usually people outside of those nations. And then the land becomes controlled by outside forces that really are not there to serve the people, whereas mm-hmm. the small-scale farmers are there to serve the people. They're part of the community. Yes, they want to earn a living, but they're not earning a big living, and they're there really as community members. So right. the connection and the responsibility and the accountability of these, of a, you know, the 75% of population that are farmers to their fellow community members is very intense, whereas agribusiness has absolutely no accountability. And they can produce things that are very unhealthy, and there's very little control over that. That's part of what's happening. And also, a place like China that has despoiled their land to such an extent that they're having trouble growing food that's not poisoned. Mm-hmm. So they're buying up land in Africa. Right. In order to feed their people. So Richard Smith has a couple of wonderful, wonderful is the wrong word because they're pretty frightening, but very thoughtful articles that are out there. He's finishing up a book on China and the environment. And, you know, part of his presentation is about needing to find other land on which to grow food for their many, many people. So right. You can see where a power like China that's fairly centralized can go into nations in Africa, for example, and just grab up land, make deals with the government, and the people are left out. And also, you know, people have been on the land for eons, you know, for many generations. And they don't have title. They never had title. It wasn't, you know, a codified society until very recently.
Right.
So they just were on the land. It's been theirs. And now it's all of a sudden somebody comes onto their land and says, I've got title. Well, what's that about? So there's been a lot of struggle, and a lot of it has been violent struggle. You know, a lot of shooting of people who are on the land to get them off.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been it's not just a sweet kind of back and forth. A lot of it is quite hostile.
Yeah, yeah. And is a country like China doing anything to try to clean up their land so they can grow food on their land, or they're just into this new model of land grabbing?
That I couldn't say. Mm-hmm. That I couldn't say. I hope they're trying to do something about cleaning up their land.
Uh-huh.
For a long-term strategy, buying up other people's land is not going to work, but I don't know. You know,
right.
The problem of short-term profit is a global problem. It's a value and an institution that is extraordinarily harmful.
Right. You know, which we deal with in this country all the time. I mean, you know, our country is ruled by corporations now, and they are all about, you know, profit and gains for their shareholders, and not at all about what's really good for people.
Yeah,
and
also
so
it's the quarterly report.
Shake these people.
The quarterly report is. I mean, the framework of profitability is the underlying poison. It's the framework that's poisonous, but the quarterly report sort of jacks up that poison. Because it's not just profits, but it's profits every 3 months. So you have to show as a CEO that you're making money all the time. And that's just, when you look at your own life, look at over a year, you see that there are certain times of the year that you're more productive, certain opportunities come your way, other times you're a little bit less productive. It's just an up and down that happens. But to have to always, and sometimes you have to invest thought and planning that doesn't reflect itself in profit.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're always looking for profit, then they're making the short-term decisions that don't serve the long-term good of anybody.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's what it's you know, the model that our country's been built on. So,
well, unfortunately, it's really the whole world. I thought it was really wonderful when Pope Francis talked about that. And, you know, I think that many Catholics are going to be more interested in going to church because he's really talking about what is the danger of an extreme capitalism. You know, in Latin America, they call it savage capitalism. So, whatever would be considered the left movement there, which is a very, very big term that doesn't really clarify much. But, you know, people might say, oh, it's savage capitalism. There are many people who would use that term who would say, but, you know, small, more socially responsible capitalists are fine. It's these big ones that don't give a damn and that are savage in the way they treat the people and the planet mm-hmm. that are the real danger.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that that's really what we're facing in a very broad way. And if maybe later on we can talk a little bit about these new trade agreements, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Yes, we certainly will. We certainly will. First, I just want to go back to your trips. Just recently you went to Guatemala and Honduras, correct?
Yes.
Can you share some of that experience with us and, you know, some of the strategies you saw the farmers using down there?
Yeah. First, I went with Grassroots International, and I just want to give them a shout-out because they are a fantastic organization. If you Google them, you can find them on the web. They're really a great organization. They raise money to give to farmer projects in the Global South. So, you know, they're all about food sovereignty. So we went with them to visit some of the projects that they are supporting in Honduras and Guatemala. So we had this amazing privilege of traveling with peasant leaders. And, they brought us to these communities that were quite far away.
Now, how large a group were you traveling with?
Only eight of us.
Picture. Eight, okay.
Eight
so
of us.
Small, okay.
It was small, and we fit into a van.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you learn so much when you are traveling, of course, especially mm-hmm. to a very poor country. And while, you know, we had decent places to stay, you know, to sleep in and stuff, but we saw communities that ranged so dramatically from truly poor, poor communities. And, you know, I was in the Peace Corps in Colombia, in Barranquilla, and I've seen poverty, third world poverty, and I've traveled a lot in Bolivia, which is a very poor country.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never seen the level of poverty that I saw in some of the communities in Honduras, the communities where they're squatting on the land, they're in these battles with corporations that are trying to take to grab the land. And there was a community of about 200 people who were living in what we would call Adirondack shelters, three-sided shelters with either thatch roofs or plastic sheeting for roofs, with a very, very small number of belongings against a wall
mm-hmm.
and a couple of pots and a stove, and really that was it. With a with a sizable family, and so proud to be working the land and to be working cooperatively with others. You know, you see a level of valiance and determination that is really, you can almost say nothing in response, because it's at a level of effort and determination that is just beyond anything I've ever experienced. And all the kids are going to school. They walk the 2 miles on the dirt road to school every day. And the women under 30 let us know that they were not going to have more than two kids. They're trying to take control over their lives. And last year they had a crop using agroecological processes, mostly what they call milpas, and that's corn and beans grown together synergistically. And often squash as well. Squash provides good foliage to hold on to the water. In
mm-hmm.
particularly dry land, it's very useful to hold on to the water. and the person who's contesting the land came in with thugs and just cut down the whole harvest. Mm. And so their work was undermined, but they planted again, and they're filing for the land, and they actually won title to the land after we left. I got word that they
great.
Had won title to the land. They're still going to have to battle this guy and his thugs because mm-hmm. the government does not really enforce very much, but it gives them some more legal status.
This is Honduras.
This is Honduras.
But it's similar probably in Guatemala, right?
Actually, they're much better off in Guatemala. I mean, Honduras is truly poor. But that was one community. There were other communities in Honduras that we visited of farmers. It's mostly women farmers again.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one thing I saw so much when I traveled in the south. And it's not that much, but I've gone to Costa Rica, Guatemala, just went to India. You know, and then, of course, the islands, you know, I've been in. And it's amazing to me the level of work that the women do. And it seems, I don't know how it was in Honduras, but it seems to me like the men are just hanging around. You know? Like,
well, I think the men are, you know, I think it's hard for me to say that the men were hanging around. I think there weren't many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as many of them who can will go into town or into the cities to get work or come to the United States. I think they're seeking work. Pay work, and they're not farming. I think the women are farming because
mm-hmm.
they're with the kids, and they see their role as maintaining the family. So so farming is compatible with that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you know the pay economy is something that is harder for them to plug into because then who's going to be home with family and who's going to maintain the agricultural
right.
tradition. So I think the men go off, and I think it undermines the family in a lot of ways.
Well, you have a trip planned to India, and I'd love to have a talk with you when you get back, but I was shocked when I was in India. The women were carrying these bundles. They were, like, out there gathering all the food to keep the cows and the animals alive over the winter. And the men are mostly hanging out having tea at the chai shops.
Well, hey, you know, I think that the expectations are very different for men
yeah.
and women. There's
yeah.
no doubt about it. Guatemala, though, let me just say about Honduras, and then I'll say
okay.
about Guatemala. The you know you see a, like almost a continuum of quality of life or living standards. And the one was certainly, you know, that community I described in Honduras. But there were other communities in Honduras that we saw where they were doing very nicely. What was nice about the community was solidarity. Very proud of their work, what they had accomplished, that they're growing food, that they're feeding their families, that their kids are going to school, you know, that they have a democratic decision-making process. You know, you sit in a circle with maybe 30 farmers, mostly women farmers, and, you know, half of them have a baby on their back or on their lap, and they're, you know, they're multitasking the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And so proud of their work. And you know, their homes are, you know, have four walls. They have, some of them have water pumps. Some of them have electric.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel that they are taking control of their lives in a really good way. So that is, you know,
that's
they have
wonderful.
Chickens, they have,
mm-hmm.
they have, they show, they proudly show you their pigs, and they show you their bulls who they collect manure from, and they use it as organic fertilizer. They're composting everything. They're doing all the things that we consider, you know, the hippy-dippy organic thing. This is how they've always lived.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they have, the chickens are going around very happy that they're pooping in all the milpas because
mm-hmm.
that's fertilizer. And, you know, there's a sense of the looks on their faces are just
proud.
Less tense. Yeah, and very proud.
Mm-hmm.
In Guatemala, I just want to say something about the political situation in Honduras first and then about Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
So about 2 weeks after we left Honduras, there was an election, and just about everybody we spoke with, because they're poor farmers, and also because they were part of Livia Campesina, were supporting the party called Libre, which is liberty and reformation. It's really about reforming the government to create land distribution. And they had a democratically elected president, Mel Zelaya, in 2007. He was violently overthrown in 2009. And then there was this totally fake election in 2011 that was boycotted by most of the political parties, so it really didn't have much standing. And they just had an election on November 24th. And I just wrote an article for The Independent on this because it's such an interesting and important process to understand. The framework of that election was intimidation. When we were traveling by van in the countryside, we would, in a three-hour trip, we were stopped six times by military checkpoints. You know, checking our passports, the licenses of the driver, you know, looking at the van. Backup of traffic because of these checkpoints. And, you know, it's harassment. It's straight-out harassment. There are so many assassinations of peasant leaders. And 2 days before the election, five Libre party activists in one of the rural communities were assassinated. I mean, the message is do not vote. And then a lot of the ruling party, the Nacional Party, went to poor communities and said, look, we won't know what your personal vote is, but when we look at your community's vote and we see you voted for Libre, if we win, we are not going to give you what is like a little extreme poverty benefit that comes from the World Bank. And so we'll know who you voted for as a community. So, you know, that's another form of intimidation.
You bet.
And then, even though all six of the political parties had credentials for poll watching, the much smaller parties were induced to sell their poll watching credentials to Nacional. And then when they actually came to the polls, there were, you know, dead people listed who voted, and there were live people who were not listed. I mean, there were all these irregularities. But the actual voting itself, outside of that, looked like regular voting. There wasn't mass intimidation on the day of the election, and they collected all the votes, and they counted the votes, and sure enough, Nacional wins. They may have won under any circumstances, but the day before, the polls were Libre all the way, you know, like 8 points ahead, and then on the actual day, it's 8 points for Nacional. So how do we understand a, quote, democratic election with all that intimidation?
Right.
So, of course, the Organization of American States and the U.S. Embassy and the European Union, immediately their observers instantly say, oh, it was a good election. This is a fair election. Of course, there were some irregularities, but we're certifying this election. But a lot of the people within those delegations said, no way, this was not a fair election. So it's really being contested, and it's such a difficult situation because you want to have a democratic election, and yet, you know, we don't even think about the framework that so many poor countries that have such a military history, you know, have to deal with. So that was Honduras, and that was, you know, very dramatic, the poverty and the intimidation and all of that. And then Guatemala, which went through, of course, a number of years of genocide of the Mayan people. I mean, nothing short of genocide. It was horrible. They seem to have come out of it with their heads down, that they have a democratically elected government that is conservative.
When was that genocide going on in Guatemala?
About 10 years ago. And before. And they They've come out of that period. A lot of the what we heard from the peasant leaders was, you know, we said, well, why do people vote for the right-wingers? And they said, well, there's a saying in Guatemala, I'm alive, and that's good enough. You know, they're not getting killed like they were being killed previously. And they're very happy that they're not being killed. So yeah. There's a sense of just let's let this process lie for a while.
Well, before we run out of time, I definitely want to talk about the world trade policy and how that affects all of this. But let's take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, then let's delve into that a little bit, okay?
Sounds great.
Okay. Don't go anywhere, everyone. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on Progressive Radio Network. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani on IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today, I'm talking with Nancy Romer, the founder of the Brooklyn Food Coalition and professor of psychology at Brooklyn College. Nancy, you back with me?
Hi, yeah, I am.
Great. So we've been talking about your travels to Guatemala and Honduras and the food sovereignty movement there. And before we run out of time, I wanted to really get into how does the world trade policies that we have in the U.S., how does that affect the food sovereignty movement of the South?
Well, just the one that's coming up ahead of us, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is just one example of, you know, what is really dangerous about these trade agreements. They supersede the national governments. That's the worst part of them. That is, they make an agreement between nations that then creates a super government decision-making process. So that if the United States decides that we want to have environmental or labor protections, we are not allowed to, if it gets in the way of profit of corporations. And that's what we're facing. You know, we saw this with NAFTA, which was the North American Free Trade Agreement, around things like genetically engineered seeds. And we saw the effects, particularly on the Mexicans, rather, in terms of pushing them off the land. The corn prices plummeted, and they could no longer sustain themselves on the land. We also saw a lot of deindustrialization as the jobs went to Mexico for the manufacturing jobs went to Mexico, where they had fewer labor rights, cheaper labor, and fewer environmental protections. So we saw this deindustrialization going on in the United States. These are very dangerous practices, and it's very important for Americans to understand that the average person is harmed by these agreements, not helped by these agreements. These agreements are all about corporate profit and absolutely nothing else. And they make it impossible for national governments to take a stand on any of these issues once they sign on to these agreements.
Right. Like, I know there was a ban on GMOs in Europe, and because of the trade agreements, they had to allow GMO products into their countries, although they did require labor, which we have not required yet, which is, you know, one of the issues I'm constantly talking about. But it was these trade agreements that so many countries that want to not allow GMO products into their country, and they're not allowed to ban them.
Right.
They're having problems. Or they threaten, you know, if you ban this, then we will take away this kind of support, you know.
Well, you know, the paradigm is we need jobs. We need jobs. We need to get more money circulating. And with that idea, they convince, they're lobbying. These corporations are putting an enormous amount of money behind the elections of the heads of state. And all of the people below the head of state, all over the world. So they are putting a lot of pressure on these people to go along with them. And these folks, these politicians would not be rising unless they were going down with the program. So they are forcing them to support their global interests, but they're totally disconnected from national interests. And it's really important to be able to make decisions locally about our labor and our environment. And these treaties negate that.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a couple examples of how that would be working against the people?
Well, I'll give you an example in El Salvador. There's been a gold mine that's been polluting the water, and the government of El Salvador has moved to stop that gold mine. So under other trade agreements, the gold mine company sued the government of El Salvador, which has very little money, for lost profits. So if you deign to stand up to these corporations for polluting your water, for example, they can sue you for lost profits. What would we have made if you didn't have this legislation? And in these international courts, they win.
You're kidding?
No.
Well, why should I be surprised?
Yeah. Of course. I mean, no. But it's shocking because it doesn't seem. How could people come up with a system that is so evil? Really. I mean, you hate to speak in these terms, but it's shocking that they would come up with these ideas. But they do, because the only thing they care about is profits. So let's say we decided that. We wanted to raise minimum wage. If we signed the Trans-Pacific Partnership, they could sue us for a corporation could sue our national government for raising labor costs. They could sue for lost profits. Or if we decided that we didn't want to have the Keystone XL pipeline, for example, Canada and the United States are on the Pacific. They'd be part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They could sue the U.S. government for lost profits.
Mm-hmm. Now, has the Trans-Pacific Partnership gone through yet, or is there still time for people to protest it?
There's still time, and unfortunately, President Obama is fast-tracking it, which means that the Congress will not really read it. They'll just get an executive summary. And, I mean, it's one of the reasons why the decision that corporations are people is so dangerous, because they're not people. They take up a lot of political space, and, we get stuck with their endless influence. So how we get out of this, is really pretty daunting. I mean, we need to have enough people to protest the Trans-Pacific Partnership and to be aware. I think this is the big thing. You know, what you're doing, Bhavani, is so important. And, you know, the non-corporate media has such an important role to play.
Mm-hmm.
To sound the alarm and let people know that there's a whole level of decision-making that they are not aware of that can be very, very harmful to them.
Yeah. I've had the petition up before. To sign the petition against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I will check to see if it's up again. If it's not, I will find a new petition, definitely post it on my website so you guys can go to my website to sign a petition on that, because, yeah, it's just another example of, you know, of corporate profits being put in front of what's good for the majority of people. And it's horrendous. It's I don't know. It's so disappointing.
Yeah, it is very disappointing.
That this is our society.
Well, you know, also in terms of food, I mean, I know you've been really talking about this a lot in terms of fracking, but
mm-hmm.
this is definitely true about gold mining. You know, we on our trip, we met with people in Honduras who were preventing the development of a gold mine
in Honduras.
And they were they had, I mean, this is so amazing. These are poor people. These are not, you know, well-off people. They had 12-hour shifts for 18 months. They would have maybe 10 to 15 people in every shift, and they would be blocking the road to prevent the gold mine from coming in because they knew that it's going to destroy, going to poison the waters, it's going to poison the land. This is what people have to understand, and the fact that so many Americans are clueless politically. They don't understand the bigger picture at all. And they
unfortunately, we're not going to have time to go into the whole story because we're just about out of time, but I wish we would. Do you have any information you'd like to share with people as far as where they can find out more information about this before we end our show? Otherwise, you can send it to me, and I'd be happy to post it, too. But
go to the Grassroots International website. You can see more there, and go to the Brooklyn Food Coalition website. We're having a party tonight at 408 Marcus Garvey Boulevard in Bed-Stuy. People are very welcome to come and celebrate with us. And just to say thank you, Bhavani, for keeping this show so prescient and important. And
thank you,
Mandy.
Thank you for joining me. Your work is so great. It's really inspiring. And, you know, I invite everybody to get involved, as Nancy does and as I do, because we all need to take this power. That's what she's talking about. That's what I always talk about. We need to take power and take this movement back. Have a great rest of the week. You've been listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. God bless you all. See you next week.